Listen to how cool this quote is. I shall smash the gates of the netherworld right down to its dwelling. I shall bring up the dead to consume the living. I shall make the dead outnumber the living.
Hashtag girl boss.
Ghost.
Ghost. Season 3 of Ghosts is coming.
Oh no. Yeah. Is it a good show? I haven't seen it.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people say that the BBC one is better, but like, of course they're going to say that. Everyone, like, there's always going to be people who are like, the original is better.
Listen, the amount of times I've heard the sentence, the BBC one was better, about everything I've ever loved.
You know
okay,
what?
Okay, I get it's fine. It's better.
But guess what? Cool. I'm not British. Do I sound British and to you? I'm American.
I'm American. Yeah.
So, yes, the... Yeah. Hi, listeners. Welcome.
Hi, everyone. We're coming in a little
snippy, perhaps.
I'm tired to my core.
Yeah, you know, what is that? What is that? It's that January malaise, like, where you feel like you want to do something, but you're like, do I really need to? Well,
And you've been, like, all ambitious for, like, a week, and now you're tired because of all the things you have to do with that, like, ambition.
Yeah. Ambition, what's that? Oh, my gosh.
Ugh.
So, we're back for part 2 of The Last of Us. Not the video game, The Last of Us Part 2. Mm. That's not. But this is.
No, which apparently hated it.
Who hated it?
They came for it.
Who hated it?
The gamers, Rhonda.
Were they? Was it all the incel male gamers who hated it?
No. I think it was like for not making characters as multidimensional as they had been in the first.
Okay,
is what I'm understanding.
I think that there's like a much larger conversation we could have about, like, oh, most of the fans of this franchise hated this one installment of it. And what does it mean when we say that? And what is actually happening when we're like, oh, everyone hated that? Like, why? Why did they hate it? Who was it who hated it? And why did they hate it?
And also, it's usually just one person who's saying, it's like the popularity
thing in high
school. It's like
somebody saw 3 tweets that kind of didn't like it, and they're like, oh, that means everyone hated it.
And
that,
yeah.
There's no nuance on the internet, but we've been knowing this. So, hi, friends.
There's only old ones.
We try to bring nuance to the internet, kind of.
And, you know.
Yeah.
Here's what you got.
So, to all 10 of you, thank you. Hello. For listening to our attempts at nuance on the internet.
Hello and welcome.
Hello and welcome to Pop DNA.
So, Rhonda.
Yes, Erin.
Given that we both potentially have home repairs to be made at some point today, what are you watching? What are you enjoying?
So I spent this morning watching season 7 of the super fan episodes of The Office, because season seven just released it like fairly recently, I think.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a fun one. That's season seven is the season where Holly comes back at the Christmas party and like Erin is like, she's like, I don't get it. Why do people like her?
It's
so funny.
I don't get it.
She's like, her ears are a 2. Her personality is a 3. Like, and Michael treats her like she's a perfect 40.
A perfect 40. My gosh, yeah. I haven't seen that in so long.
Yeah, and then there's, like, of course, with the thing with the superfan episodes, for those who don't know, is that it's basically, like, a recut of the episode that includes some deleted material. Yeah. So I don't think that it includes, like, everything.
Sure.
That was taken out of the episode that originally aired, but, like, they include, like, it's probably, like, whatever deleted scenes are on the DVD special features, that's, like, what's included.
Yeah.
In the expanded episodes. There might be, like, an extra scene or two, and some episodes there's, like, a whole, like, C-plot storyline that was cut from the original episode.
That's awesome.
Yeah, well, like, you've watched them before, right? Yeah, so you know.
Yeah, they're fun. They're nice.
Or, like, I think, like, most often what happens is that, like, the scene, like, made it into the episode, but there were, like, a few extra lines that were cut, right. And so those are included. So, yeah, like, it's just fun to see what was taken out and kind of think about, like, why things were taken out for, you know, yeah. Like, how they choose what to take out, because obviously they have to get it to fit within a certain time limit.
Sure, yeah.
But then, like, how do you choose what to cut for that time limit?
Yeah, so, yeah, how it's do interesting. You pick, like, how do you, like, analyze your audience for what would play the best? How do you see what works in the overall plot the best? What was a really great joke that you love and are proud of and maybe doesn't, like, further the plot? Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. And you can kind of see those things where you're like, okay, I understand why this part was cut. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And then I'll also, sometimes what I've done when I watch the Superfan, like, when the new season of Superfan episodes is released, I'll then, like, if I have a question or something about that, then I'll, like, go to the Office Ladies podcast and listen to their episode on that episode to see if they talk about that. Because they, like, sometimes on Office Ladies, they talk about, like, what deleted scenes there were and stuff. So it's interesting.
But, that's awesome.
Yeah, if you want a deep dive on The Office, that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I started rereading, actually listening to, a book that I read probably like 10 years ago.
Nice.
But I was reminded of it because I think that I didn't mention it last week, but after our episode last week, I like remembered this book and was like, oh, this should be included in our conversation about apocalyptic fiction and zombies in fiction. So it's Zone One by Colson Whitehead. I don't know if I've mentioned it before.
I don't think have. I think I've heard about it in passing, but
Yeah. So like I said, I read it like 10 years ago and like I've thought about it periodically, you know, since then, but hadn't really gone back and revisited.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting, like, thinking about it. Because, like, I think at the time that I first read it, I was familiar with, like, zombie movies, but hadn't really explored any other, like, forms of zombie fiction. And now I have. And I have, like, a much richer context for it. So maybe it was actually like more than 10 years ago that I read it.
Yeah.
It was quite a while ago. It was quite a while ago.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite a while. So yeah, it's interesting. So Colson Whitehead, I think, is known as kind of like a literary crossover author. So he writes like literary fiction, but there's like some kind of like popular fiction like genre fiction crossover appeal. So like it's a zombie novel, but it's also written in a way that reads as very literary. if you like that kind of writing.
Yeah. So you're into that kind of thing.
Yeah, if you're into that kind of thing. But then there's also zombies. So it's like you know. I think like Cormac McCarthy is maybe kind of a good like comparison.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like literary, but like he's also like a very popular author.
And he drops some apocalypse in there sometimes. Yeah.
So he drops some apocalypse in there. That's Cormac McCarthy. Okay. You're gonna talk about Cormac McCarthy.
I haven't
a little later.
I have his book on my desk right now. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he'll be so enthused.
Listen,
to hear that.
You should be honored to get on my bookshelf. Forget about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what have you? It looks like you've got a whole list of books here. What are you reading?
I have tied myself to my Goodreads account, and I am just having so much fun reading. So, I think I've mentioned it, but I've started to substitute teach, which is very fun, but it's also a whole different level of tired once you're done with it. So,
oh yeah,
I've been turning to the books. Gosh, like 6 months ago, I was reading Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin. Mm-hmm. And then I did that thing. It's that thing of where you read the whole thing until like 100 pages left, and then like you've oversaturated, so you kind of take a step back, or something
yeah.
like sad happens in the book, so you pause. So I read the final 100 pages of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. Immediately fell so much back in love with her voice as an author, the way that she explores grief and humor. And I read it and I thought, I must have more from this author. So I walked over to King's Books just to see what they had. And they had another, she's prolific. She's written so many books. And they just happened to have Young Jane Young. Which is...
Love the title.
It's pretty good.
Going great so far.
Going great so far. Oh, I'm only just realizing now, after having read to fifth graders yesterday, my voice is gone, so please bear with me. But Young Jane Young is the story of basically what happens to the family of someone who goes through similar things as like a Monica Lewinsky, right? So
a young woman
who goes to intern and then is kind of all of the blame and all of the jokes are placed on her. So we sit with the character Aviva and her family, and that's where the humor comes into the grief, comes into the sadness about the world in a really beautiful way. So she's from Florida, and her mom, you know, lives in a retirement community in Florida. So you get kind of the jokes there, like as she grapples with aging and her point of view chapters. And then you get the character of Aviva, who is the intern who has gone through all of this. And spoiler alert, if anyone doesn't want it, just pause or fast forward like 2 minutes. But Aviva changes her name to Jane Young. And so on the back of the book, you get Jane Young as a character, Aviva as a character, and then the other characters. And so then halfway through the book, Jane Young has gone through her chapters, and then the next chapter is Aviva's chapter. So you come to understand.
So they're going like back and forth in time.
Yeah, and she's changed her name.
Kind of like how in Westworld, the man in black was like the future version of the guy from like the other. Whatever happened to Westworld?
Whatever happened to Westworld?
I don't know. Anyway.
My favorite feature, though, of Jane Young, or of Young Jane Young, is the last chapter. It's like 100 pages or something. Or no, probably not. It's probably like 40 pages. And it's a choose-your-own-adventure as Aviva telling the story of how she got taken advantage of by the congressman. And the other choices are blacked out. So it makes,
so there, like, she had no choices.
She had no choices. It's a really interesting look at power dynamics. Just, you know, I got chills just in seeing those, the two decisions that she might wanted to have made or not, were crossed out into, and only the ones that did happen. And so removing it, because we always talk about it as choice, but sometimes there is no choice in though, especially when it comes to those power dynamics. And so I just thought that was really, really powerful and an interesting way to explore that And I just, I loved this book. And then I'm like 300 pages into Priory of the Orange Tree. Those are, and then Top Chefin when I have the time. Oh, I also.
Top Chefin. Yeah.
Every so often. So every so often I go for my Irish gals. So Catastrophe with Sharon Horgan, and then This Way Up by Ashlyn B. And the episodes go by so quickly that I just do them both as a set every so often.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
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 My Irish ladies.
And Sharon.
So those are your Irish ladies.
Those are my Irish ladies.
My Irish ladies.
Yeah. Sorry.
Do you want to hear about my Irish ladies?
I do.
Because it's Saoirse.
Saoirse.
And, and Nicole Kidman from Far and Away.
Ah, the best.
She's not even Irish.
The best Irish ladies. Okay. Nicole Kidman played a cult leader in Nine Perfect Strangers.
Oh, yes.
And she's like,
I meant to watch that.
You gotta. She's such a natural-born cult leader. She's so good.
I mean, just the AMC intro alone tells me that she could command millions.
And you know what? So. She really plays into, like, finding a way to make herself creepy. It's so good.
Nicole Kidman, the woman you are. You know, I really admire the choices that Nicole Kidman has made. And I mean, obviously part of that is like that she actually has the opportunities to make the choices that she's made.
Yeah.
But like she's made really interesting choices.
No kidding, man.
And I like that.
No, I agree. I agree.
That was a stretch.
I was proud of it. I stand by it.
You should be doing some yoga if you're going to stretch that much.
Plot twist, I am doing some yoga.
Currently, right now. Currently doing yoga as we're recording. We call it yoga courting.
Yoga courting.
Yoga casting.
But you have to be also eating yogurt anyway.
Yes. Go-gurt, preferably.
Anytime you're going anywhere, it better not be yogurt. It has to be go-gurt.
You know, with all the... bloat of merchandising that we've seen of Grogu from The Mandalorian. It shocks me that they didn't do Grogurt.
Come on.
Where is the Grogurt?
Where's my Grogurt?
Lucasfilm.
Come on.
Okay.
Where's my Grogurt?
Where's the Grogurt?
Where are the turtles?
Yeah, where are the turtles? Now I'm going to have to go look at turtles on the internet to call myself Tao.
I might need to watch that episode. I haven't seen that in a
long time. Oh my gosh, so good. And then when he's like, don't let Emily have any of the pecans. She's allergic.
She's allergic.
Okay. So what are we... Hi, we have a thing. We have things to talk about here.
And stuff.
No, then there yet. So we are talking... about The Last of Us, which is a show that I'd like to point out is not actually post-apocalyptic because the apocalypse is ongoing, right? Like there was like the big major catastrophic event, but it's kind of still happening even 20 years later.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, we're talking about the apocalypse and... why are we so interested in the apocalypse, Erin? What did you find?
I really feel like I just did a literary review. I really enjoyed it, though. I had a lot of nerdy fun. So we'll start here just with the definition of apocalyptic text, which was taken lovingly from our Wikipedia friends. So
the old Wikipedia, yes.
Apocalyptic and post-apocalyptic, which I cannot say, apocalyptic fiction. Is a subgenre of science fiction in which the Earth's or another planet's civilization is in process of collapsing or has collapsed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The apocalyptic event may be climactic, you know, maybe astronomical, more like an impact event. Think of the dinosaurs.
Poor dinosaurs.
Poor freaking dinosaurs. Somewhere two dinosaurs
are. Oh, did you see that movie that came out last year that was called like I forget what it was called, but it was like this astronaut had to like go back in time to Earth, like during the dinosaurs, and then like the asteroid hit, like the meteorite hit, and he had to like escape. Yeah, it wasn't very good. Yeah, anyway, go on.
No, that sounds like something that should be added to our list, though, because that's what we're talking about, you know? Mm-hmm. So we're thinking climate change, which we kind of, unfortunately, are a little bit in right now. Astronomical, such as an impact. Destructive, such as, you know, a nuclear holocaust, resource depletion, that sort of a thing. Medical, which we really just almost went through in our little pandy there.
Like, it's currently happening.
It's currently, currently happening. And there is a thought about the end of days in somehow there is a major change which is occurring in the process of occurring, or has occurred. And it can also be like two of these, right? So it could be astronomical leading to medical, right? It can, these pieces can kind of come together.
Or I think of the Hunger Games, because like the backstory of the Hunger Games is that like several of these things happened in the distant past.
Yeah.
And then Penem rose up from the people who were left. So like Hunger Games is on like a, you know, super like far future timeline.
Right.
In comparison to other apocalypse things, but like it kind of had that as its origins.
And you know, I forgot to mention in What Are We Watching, but I also just watched Don't Look Up, which I think
what did you think?
I thought Leonardo DiCaprio playing a misogynist scientist worked really well. I think it could be, if Hunger Games is placed on, if Jennifer Lawrence in Hunger Games is placed on one side of the spectrum of kind of range of events, range of motion, I think Don't Look Up could be placed maybe at the far other side. So it's just starting. I thought Ariana Grande was hilarious.
Oh, she was really funny. Yeah.
She, like, way to play yourself in such, like, a heightened way. I thought that was great. I thought this could have been a first draft. I really enjoyed it, but I thought it could have gone
other places. That's a really great way of putting it. Like, yeah, like, it's definitely an outline for a story.
Yeah, exactly that. An outline, a first run, maybe like your pre-Broadway run before you do the actual thing. It felt interesting.
See, I think it's like an even earlier iteration than that. Like, it's the first draft of a screenplay where you haven't even like worried about fleshing out characters or like actually honing your message. You're just like, hey, wouldn't it be fun to put a bunch of famous people in a movie that kind of has a message that people maybe generally agree with.
Yeah.
So we don't really have to really work. Saying anything.
Yeah. It kind of felt like back in college when we would do, like, you have to write a play in a week and it has to go up at the end of that week, that kind of thing. It kind of felt like a really good one of those.
Good as being generous.
if a bunch of college kids had written this in
like
a week.
High budget. High budget. Yeah, sure.
I thought Kate Blanchett was funny. I didn't know it was her for like the first 40 minutes.
Right?
I was like, but I feel like this could be placed at the very beginning of that kind of timeline of apocalyptic to post-apocalyptic. And, you know, it does include here, of course, a zombie apocalypse, a cybernetic revolt.
Like Terminator. Or The Matrix.
Or The Matrix, those kind of things. An alien invasion. Any types of major change where it's not gonna go back anytime soon. We're not speeding back is what we think of when we think of apocalyptic. And so our oldest surviving apocalyptic text is from ancient Mesopotamia, the Sumerian creation myth, and the Epic of Gilgamesh. And I actually have a really cool quote here from Gilgamesh.
Whoa, quote.
From Ishtar.
Ishtar's
like, Ishtar's the shit.
Man. Yeah. Like, no, absolutely.
Yeah.
Listen to how cool this quote is. I shall smash the gates of the nether world right down to its dwelling. To the world below, I shall grant manumission. I shall bring up the dead to consume the living. I shall make the dead outnumber the living. And that's from the
hashtag girl boss.
That's from the Epic of Gilgamesh. You know, that's really, these words they're old, yeah. You guys. These words are old, and I think that they're really gripping and beautiful and interesting.
That's so interesting, because I have always talked about, so in the book of Revelation in the Bible, there's like writings about like what, you know, is called like the second coming of Christ. And there's like, actually, I don't know if this particular quote is in Revelation or if it's somewhere else, but anyway, so there's like a quote that's like, the dead in Christ shall rise. And I have always like theorized that that's talking about zombies. Like,
oh, interesting.
Right? Like, and then, I mean, there's also like in Christian theology and Christian belief, we believe that like Jesus literally came back to life from when he was dead. So yeah. Like, you could interpret that as like zombie. And I think but then like that just like kind of goes back to like the origins of these myths of like zombies and vampires, because like vampires especially are very closely connected to like origins in Christian like our Western European kind of conception of a vampire is very connected to Christian mythology. Anyway, sorry to derail us.
No, I don't think it does, because I had a note somewhere in here later, but I was thinking really about when these things have been written about for as long as we've been telling stories, as long as we've been having these conversations, we've been thinking about decay of the body and death and what our human biology is. And I think a really interesting way to conceptualize the human body is to think about zombies, is to think about, oh, I'm watching, like, I see plants die, I see animals die, and I eat them. I also am made of flesh. Oh, I also am capable of decay. I see family members pass away. I see, you know, other people that I know, and I'm just thinking about, if you don't have like knowledge of science, if we haven't gotten there yet, and we're thinking about what it is to be a body and what it is to have that, just the flesh of your body decay and, you know, go through that process. I think thinking about zombies is a really interesting thing, and probably felt really, really unsteady and really scary, especially too, like, if we're thinking about decay, there could have been like an illness or a toxin or a toxicity. Yeah. And I can imagine where it would be interesting as a writer to explore what these like foundations of zombies are, you know?
Yeah. Science and like mythology and where they kind of interact is
interesting. Yeah. And then you bring in the human soul and religion and all of it, and what is a human being and what makes us different from any other living thing. Like, it's just interesting thought processes to kind of listen to and read foundationally here. Then, so not, I don't think that this is the next one, but the next one on my journey was The Last Man, Mary Shelley in 1826. And this is from an article about this text from The Conversation. It's a guide to the classics. Mary Shelley's The Last Man is a prophecy of life in a global pandemic by Olivia Murphy. just to ground this text, we're talking about the apocalypse and how apocalypse and zombies have dealt with like a total death of a world, right? Like the humans have died, but so has the world. And so she writes, in contrast to this total death, Shelley asks her readers to imagine a world in which only humans are becoming extinct. Attacked by a new unstoppable plague, the human population collapses within a few years. In their absence, other species flourish. A rapidly decreasing band of survivors watches as the world begins to return to a state of conspicuous natural beauty. A global Garden of Eden.
Yeah, that's interesting to think about. Because, like, when, for, like, some things that I was thinking about and researching for this week, like, that was, like, kind of an idea that I had come up against, like, that in The Last of Us, like, obviously, you know, it's a very dark and bleak story. But, I mean, like, there's the similarity with this and, like, The Last Man, The Last of Us, right? Like, very, like, this is the same idea. Yeah. But, like, when there are sort of, like, moments of beauty or of hope in The Last of Us, it's almost always nature, you know, coming back and thriving in the absence of humanity. Yeah. So I think that's so interesting and still kind of dark because, you know, it's saying that, like, for the natural world to thrive, humanity has to be gone. That's such a, that's an interesting idea.
And some people were writing about this when we were all shut in our homes for COVID. People were observing a change in some parts of the world where, like, I think it was the National Park Service and different things were thriving a little bit and like campgrounds because, you know, maybe there wasn't litter. Maybe there wasn't like they're trampling
there's
on
way
the
less
grounds.
Traffic on
way
the roads.
Less traffic. And there was kind of this discussion there of like, friends, I am not, you know, I'm not saying that that was a good time, but there was a conversation about.
This is nature's reset button.
The impact, like, that we do have. You know? So it's just an interesting kind of both and thing. It was terrible to be, you know, trapped in our homes, but also, and also, we could be treating the world differently. So just something that was on a lot of people's minds. And so as we kind of think about the apocalypse, I did want to think a little bit about pre-collapse, but I really highlighted 1984 here because I don't get to talk about it enough. But there are kind of signs of a pre-collapse where, at least in the case of 1984, the society is no longer working well at all, right? It's no longer, it's gone off the rails, even for the people who think that they're leading the government. So 1984 tells the story of a world in peril as it all leads toward an end. We don't get to that end. We only get to that end for the character, but we don't get to that end as a society. But there are three really key moments or key concepts that are explored there. So there's the term of double speak, and double speak is the language of 1984 that deliberately obscures, disguises, distorts, or reverses the meaning of a word. And we're going to get to this a little bit more when we talk about revenants and different types of zombies. But a revenant zombie is something that is so fixed on an idea that it becomes zombie-like. It might not be a decaying body. It might be, you know, a decaying mind. And I think that's what we see in 1984 with doublespeak. So,
but like on a societal level.
Yeah.
In 1984.
The society has become, the leaders of the society have become so intent on their own survival at the cost of others that they have deliberately changed the messaging from, you know, moment to moment. They are, they're burning
kinda like,
newspaper.
Kind of like some people kinda, I could think of now.
Kind of like maybe now.
Yeah.
The lead character in 1984 is his job is to rewrite newspapers for the headlines. What if that was happening?
What if that was happening now? We wouldn't let that happen.
We wouldn't let that be happening. The other term I think of is doublethink. It's a process of indoctrination in which subjects are expected to simultaneously accept two conflicting beliefs as truth, often at odds with their own memory or sense of reality. And I think a really key example of that is the Ministry of Peace in the book is actually the Ministry of War.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those things kind of just paved the way for how I was thinking about Revenants and how.
Yeah. Well, I think it paves the way for this discussion about like politics in The Last of Us and like how portrays or how it perceives, you know, governmental systems or like any organizational system that humans create to kind of make sense of the world.
Yeah.
So, like, of course, in The Last of Us, we have Fedra, which is sort of like the remnants of the U.S. government, right?
Yeah.
And, like, it's clearly, you know, a very totalitarian, fascist, even governing body, right? And like, the show, and I'm assuming the video game, is, like, very obviously opposed to such a form of government, right? Like the good guys are fighting against Fedra, right?
Yeah.
But then like it kind of takes the same view of like groups that are trying to fight against Fedra, right?
Yeah.
This was a good article called The Politics of the Last of Us by Ilya Solman. So she kind of points out that like, you know, what's left of the U.S. government has become a series of, quote, quarantine zones that are all ruled by Fedra. So this says, Fedra can perhaps be seen as a kind of right-wing military dictatorship, but left-wing alternatives are not portrayed much more favorably. When Joel and Ellie reach the ruins of Kansas City, they find that the Fedra government there has been overthrown by a more progressive resistance movement. But the new regime, led by Melanie Lynskey, is just as cruel and repressive as the old. And then also, like, when we meet the Fireflies and learn more about, like, their goals and what they're willing to do to reach their goals, we're kind of, I feel like as the audience, we're kind of meant to not side with the Fireflies either. So it's really interesting how The Last of Us really doesn't seem to have any faith whatsoever in humans to organize into a system that will benefit people, which I think is really interesting. But then, of course, we do have the one example of, like, sort of communism, which you know, I think has been kind of, like, proposed as like the diametric opposite of fascism, which that's not exactly true. Right. Like it's different things, but anyway,
it's easy to say that. It's really easy to say that.
Right. So we have Jackson, the community that Tommy lives in. So this is like, it's not really communism, like because it's still, because, like, there's still a lot of scarcity, right? Like, there's no, like nobody really has everything that they need, even in Jackson. Like, they've kind of, like, done the best that they could. They've made it as, you know, kind of egalitarian as they could within this world. But there's also still, like, how aggressively they, you know, fight against, like, outsiders. So, like, It's not quite communism. But this is an interesting quote about Jackson that I found in my research. This is from
The Last of Us, Communism or Barbarism by Salvador Medina Ramirez. So this says, although in The Last of Us, it is only at the end of the world when everything has collapsed, including capitalism, that it becomes possible to imagine another world. It is not necessary that millions die to build one, nor to imagine the end of capitalism. This is what we should remember. In the face of the climate crisis created by capitalism, which threatens life as we know it and human civilization as a whole, the solution is collective. So the thrust of this article was that this is not truly communism because it's, you know, apart from like some other structural things, like it's only benefiting the people in this one group, often at the expense of others.
Right.
So this goes on to say, the creation of isolated communes is not enough in the face of a problem that requires global coordination. So I think that that point about how like it's only after civilization has collapsed that we can envision a possibility of a communist community, which I think is, yeah, that's interesting in itself.
Yeah. It's an interesting place to be sitting, to be hearing all of this and studying all of this as it's kind of around us a little bit. It's, I'm just kind of sitting there a little bit like, oh, this sounds a little bit familiar. So,
Anyway. Yeah, definitely. And I think that like The Last of Us kind of falls into a trend, I think, that not a trend necessarily, but like a sort of like truth that's like taken for granted in a lot of especially like American fiction, that given like these circumstances, humans are not going to be altruistic. We're not going to, you know, like it's going to be every person for themselves. But I think that, you know, when we look at how situations similar to this, not on this scale, obviously, but like, like during like the early days of the COVID pandemic, like, yeah, there were some people who, you know, were like just trying to make sure that they had what they needed and, you know, F everybody else. But most people that I observed were trying to reach out and see how they could help other people.
Yeah, absolutely. Right?
Like people were checking in on their neighbors. People were offering to, you know, like pick up groceries for people. Like people really came together as a community, like as even as like a global community. Like, you know, people were posting like on social media and on the internet about like you would see the videos of like people in Italy like singing on their balconies, right? Like, like there, it was very much like a time when people felt like we were a global community and we wanted to support each other.
Yeah.
So I think that this tendency in fiction to show humans as doing the opposite, I think is really interesting. Like, where is that coming from? I don't know.
I think it comes from like an anger or a frustration. Cause like, I think of those moments too, or when like the nurses would come home and everyone would like applaud them as they walked home, that kind of thing. I think it comes from a frustration. I think there's a natural frustration about all of this and kind of a need to blame something, right? Mm-hmm. Like a need to get that frustration out somewhere, that fear out somewhere, because we always talk about anger as a secondary emotion that's kind of hiding a deeper vulnerability.
Yeah.
And I think it comes from fear or sadness or, you know, disgust or what, you know, whatever the case may be. Because I definitely see that through line too of like a need to kind of work through some of this, you know.
Yeah. I did want to talk about Station 11. I will never pass up an opportunity to talk about Station 11. So you still haven't watched it, have you?
I still haven't watched it.
Oh, Aaron. Oh, Aaron. No.
I can't do it.
Is it just because you're going to love it too much? Is that what the problem is?
I think it is. Yeah, you know, I'm a really big rewatcher, and yeah. I fall asleep. And I've mentioned on the cast before. I fall asleep in everything. Sure. So like for me to watch something new.
Yeah.
So the conditions have to be right. But yeah.
So yeah. So I did want to talk about Station 11 in comparison to The Last of Us, and I think that this was like. This is a comparison that was like really obvious, and a lot of people made this leap because like they're both on HBO. they were, you know, they're both 20 years post societal collapse, but that's kind of where the similarities end, honestly.
Yeah, sure.
Like even in like what I've been trying to talk through here about like how they view humans and humanity and humans' tendency toward altruism versus like individualism, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is interesting. In The Last of Us, you have this kind of through line, the saying of endure and survive, right?
Yeah.
And then in Station 11, there is this motto that like the group that the main character is part of, like this is their motto, survival is insufficient. So, I mean, those two things, just looking at, you know, comparing those two sayings alone, like you can already see yeah. how wildly different these outlooks are, right?
Yeah.
You know, like I said, like a lot of people have compared these two shows, including Alison Herman for The Ringer. And she wrote Two Sides of the HBO Apocalypse. So this is a really good, I found several articles that were saying that like one show is better than the other. And uh-huh. I mean, I have my own opinion about which one is better. But I think like yeah. what's a more interesting discussion is what we can take from each of them, right? So, right. Yeah. So in Herman's article, she says, The Last of Us is not as overtly humanist as Station 11, because Station 11 definitely depicts like communities coming together to help each other, humans choosing to not just survive, but thrive. Like, art and music are yeah. really important. There's a character in one of the communities who starts a newspaper. There's a character who starts like a civilization museum. So like he collects like people's electronics that are useless now wow. and like puts them in a museum. Yeah. So like there's just a lot more hope and a lot more optimism about humans and how we treat each other in very adverse circumstances.
Yeah.
But there, I mean, like, there is conflict, too, in Station 11. Sure. I don't want you to be like, oh, this is all, like, sunshine. No, like, there's some pretty dark, deep conflict as well. But anyway, so Herman goes on to say, a shared affinity for their character's psychology is what makes both adaptations work as TV, a medium that rewards fleshing out as many points of view as possible. And as takes on the apocalypse. So figuring out what a character's answer is to, like, she's talking about, like, you know, finding a reason to survive. Figuring out what a character's answer is to why, you know, they feel they need to survive proves far more interesting than outrunning an imminent threat.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, you know, last week we talked about, is The Last of Us a zombie show? Well, it doesn't really matter if it is or not, because that's not what it's about, right?
Right, yeah.
And I think that with Station 11, by just removing, you know, like not even having zombies, it makes you more able to focus on the human psychology.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
One other thing I kind of mentioned, this was like one more article that I found that was like comparing the two. And this kind of pointed out something that I had mentioned as well about like how all of the, or like most of the like moments of like hope or optimism in The Last of Us have to do with nature and not with humanity. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this article says, Station 11 focused not on the planet being destroyed to the point of no return, but instead on society after it had time to rebuild itself.
The cinematography didn't fill the viewer with dread about the end of the world. It was oddly hopeful. The lush green landscape of a future without humanity's incessant interference felt nourishing and whole because, this is me editorializing, because humans can enjoy it, right? Like, that's the hope. If there's any hope in this post-apocalyptic world, it's that humans can still thrive.
Yeah.
The characters, though surviving without luxuries, seem to be enjoying what they have while relying on art to get them through another day. It's much more optimistic perspective than The Last of Us, and the series wove more nuance into its world. So, it's definitely more optimistic for sure than The Last of Us. I don't know that that necessarily makes it better.
Sure.
Because I think, you know, we can have room for a pessimist point of view. I mean, we have a lot of fiction that's really pessimistic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would just say, like, if you've been noticing that and you want something that touches on similar themes but is more hopeful, watch Station 11.
Station 11.
That's my plug.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, we have, like, some more stuff about zombies, and we have, like, lists of other fiction works that explore zombies or apocalypse in general. And you know what, Erin? I think a lot of the things on our list are also very pessimistic.
I do too. My biggest idea here that I was excited about was that The Handmaid's Tale, like, Aunt Lydia is actually a revenant because she's driven by that singular burning purpose.
Yes.
And that is something that revenant zombies were said to have done without actually, like, rotting or falling apart. It was like a rot of the soul. But that's as pessimistic as it comes, I think.
Yeah. I think the world of The Handmaid's Tale, I would say, is bleaker than that of The Last of Us.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, because it takes things like religion and science and human thought and turns them evil, right? And uses them to create evil. And it's just, you know, it's the worst of us instead of the last of us.
I will say, did you watch the last episode of The Last of Us yet?
I haven't. I haven't done it. I have to do that today.
Okay. So I don't want to spoil anything for you, but there is a question, like kind of a thematic question that's brought up in the final episode. I mean, it's been kind of like foreshadowing throughout the season, but in the final episode, you're kind of forced to face this idea of bodily autonomy, and especially bodily autonomy for a young woman.
Ooh, yeah.
And so I think that, you know, I mean, that is what The Handmaid's Tale is all about, right?
Yeah.
Like, absolutely. That's the big selling point. But I think that The Last of Us is kind of more in keeping with this pessimistic theme. It's more sinister about how it introduces that idea.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I think you should still watch it, but, like, trigger warning, I guess.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah. And I mean, there was already, like, I mean, this is, like, verging into, like, what I plan to talk about next week. But, like, there's already in the episode with the, like, cannibal cult, Ellie's bodily autonomy being threatened was already introduced. And I have so many thoughts about that, but
oh my gosh,
that yeah. Should we just talk about some zombies now? Let's talk about some zombies, because you could argue that zombies have had their bodily autonomy taken away as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell me about Handmaid's Tale and Revenants. You started then I interrupted.
No, just really thinking about how, so I have this definition of revenant zombies that I'll start here. So the revenant is an older, then this is directly from TVtropes.com.
Oh, love it.
Almost as good as ye old Wikipedia.
Almost as good, but not quite.
Yeah.
The Revenant is an older variety of zombie originating in European folklore. Revenants are less prone to rotting and falling apart than other zombies. In addition to normally retaining intelligence and memories of their previous lives, they are driven by a single burning purpose, most often vengeance or true love, driven by a desire so strong it can overcome even death. And if that isn't Aunt Lydia, I don't know what is.
Yeah.
So thinking about her character, and granted, I stopped watching because it got too far from the original text for me, and that sounds really...
Have you read The Testaments, which was like the sequel book?
I gotta do it. Did you like it?
I thought it was... Okay. Did I like it? I don't know. Did I think it was interesting? Yes.
Okay.
So what's really interesting about The Testaments is that Margaret Atwood wrote it because she was so inspired by the performance of the actress who plays Aunt Lydia in the show. So it's actually like kind of canonizing, quote unquote, what's happened in the show, because The Testaments picks up, I think it's like 15 years later, and it refers back to events that happened in the show beyond where it adapts the book. So it's all kind of, you know, one shared universe, which I just think was a really interesting thing to do, especially for like people who disagreed with the direction that the show went after it ran out of book to adapt.
Yeah,
so I just thought it was really interesting. And I mean, like it's Margaret Atwood. Like, she's a good writer. So, like,
she's a freaking good writer.
It's good.
And Anne Dowd
I have read a couple of Margaret Atwood's books that I didn't enjoy, but, you know,
that's fine. I think more than anything, I really just burnt, like, I couldn't sit through an hour of Handmaid's Tale. Torture porn. Yeah.
It's torture porn. Yeah.
It was upsetting, obviously. But yeah, I just think Anne Dowd is such an incredible actress in this show.
Yeah.
But given that Revenants can be just that single burning purpose, and thinking of the character of Aunt Lydia as she sees the world on the verge of a collapse to a new order, she's clinging to her power and she's clinging to her survival, and she does so with that, to quote this article again, singular burning purpose. Instead of the, you know, the age-old zombie saying brains as they walk towards the brain, she's really saying, you know, morality, or, you know, whatever your word is, as she walks hauntingly towards these young women. And I, as soon as I read this definition of a revenant, because they had started to be talked about the revenants in like 1190 or something.
Yeah, it's pretty old.
Aaron Mankey was talking about them, so I was thinking about
Of course
he was. So I was thinking about these kind of first thoughts about zombies, and then I looked up Revenant and I got this definition, and all I could think about was Aunt Lydia. And, you know, zombies also turn other... Once bitten, you turn into a zombie yourself. Or once you get indoctrinated, then you turn into potentially an Aunt Lydia. What I love most about The Handmaid's Tale itself is that I think in those last few pages, there is an approach, a lens to view those pages where you don't know if Offred is starting to
turn. If she's drunk the Kool-Aid.
Yeah. Right? Is she, for survival's sake, is she?
Right.
And obviously that's not the road that the television show took us on. But I think that's just as interesting of a conversation. Is it goes back to 1984. That's a similar thing. In 1984, it ends with him being beaten until he believes in Big Brother. Like, yeah. It's very much zombie of the brain with these kind of cataclysmic ideas.
Yeah. I think it's so interesting to think of the handmaids as, like, you know, attempted revenants, right? Like, they're kind of attempting to turn them into brainwashed zombie-like automatons. Because I brought this up when we were planning this episode, but I did not include Pride and Prejudice and Zombies on my list of zombie works, but like, it really should be on here. Cause like, it's not really apocalyptic, because it's like, society is going on as usual. There's just zombies wandering around.
Uh-huh.
But one thing that I love, like, about Pride and Prejudice and Zombies that, like, really is kind of, like, on the nose about, like, the metaphor. So Charlotte Lucas, who in the original Pride and Prejudice marries Mr. Collins. So in Pride, Prejudice, and Zombies, she comes to tell Lizzie that she's going to marry Mr. Collins. And then she also reveals that she was bitten by a zombie. So that means she's going to turn into a zombie. And so then that is what happens. She gets married, and then she gradually turns into a zombie, right? So it's this very – it's very on the nose, but I kind of love it. Like, I this love it metaphor too. About women. I mean, like, especially women in Jane Austen's time, or, you know, at many, many – earlier times in history where marriage was their only option, but it was also kind of a death sentence, because that means that you're going to be giving birth to children, and women very often died in childbirth. So, like, Charlotte's going to turn into a zombie because she's getting married. Like, that's so good. And it's I think it's a more humorous example, but it dovetails with your theory of, like, the handmaids as revenants, or as, like, some kind of, like, you know, they're attempting to turn them into zombies, because, like, you know, the attempt is that the handmaids will fall in line under this, you know, patriarchal autocratic system, right?
Yeah.
Which, not unlike Regency England, we'll just say. So Pride and Prejudice and Zombies.
So they're the same text. Pride and Prejudice. It's the same.
And The Handmaid's Tale. It's the same thing. I'm sure Margaret Atwood would be delighted with that, with that analysis.
Yes.
And then, like, well, next week I'm going to talk more about, like, gender and patriarchy and that kind of stuff in The Last of Us, but there's definitely a connection to be drawn there as well.
Yeah.
We're kind of running long here, but what other thing do we really need to talk about regarding apocalypse or zombies?
My list is pretty set. What else do you feel is really important?
So I mentioned The Girl with All the Gifts, both the book by M.R. Carey and the film adaptation, and Severance by Ling Ma as both having, like, very interesting zombie science. Because they're both so, like, I think traditionally we see, like, it's like a virus that you get that turns you into a zombie. And then, of course, in The Last of Us, it's a fungus. In Girl with All the Gifts, it's also a fungus. And I think in Severance, it is a fungus, but the way that they're passed is by spores, like, in the air, which is so interesting. Yeah, so it's just, like, I love, like, you know, the science behind zombies. And then...
Yeah.
So The Girl with All the Gifts, to kind of bring this back around to this idea of, like, optimism in an apocalypse. So The Girl with All the Gifts, I would argue, ends on an optimistic note.
Okay.
However, it's still kind of bleak for, like, the old
ways of humanity.
Okay.
It's, yeah. It's interesting. It's interesting.
Yeah.
And I like it. So I might need to reread that. I need to reread The Girl with All the Gifts and Severance. I'm already rereading Zone 1.
I have my copy of The Girl with All the Gifts. I was going to start it today. Yeah, I'm excited. I haven't done it yet. Yeah.
It's great. And then, like, Severance also brings in the discussion of, like, labor under capitalism and how that kind of makes all of us zombies. So anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
It's great. We don't have enough time to talk about.
Well, we can continue that. Like, we can also do a little more next week.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we kind of will, because like a lot of this has kind of already started to spill over into what we plan to talk about next week. But yeah,
this fun.
Is great. If you've stuck around this long, thank you.
Thank you. And also at the same time, you're welcome.
You're welcome. Yes. Mm. To quote The Rock, you're welcome. Okay. Well, please come back next week.
Please.
We're gonna have fun.
We promise.
We're gonna talk about Gamergate. Erin's gonna talk about Destiny's Child, because she never shuts up about Destiny's Child. And honestly, who could blame her?
Who could blame me, indeed?
Okay. We'll do that. We have not posted on Instagram in many weeks.
Many weeks.
We should maybe do that.
We have the best of intentions.
We do. But, you know, life and things.
We mean well.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's what's in store. So come back.
Come,
if you,
please.
If you feel like it.
Rhonda and Aaron's podcast, please come.
That was what the... What our book club, what I called it on the thing. It was like, it was like super casual,
non-committal,
no pressure book club. Please come.
Parentheses, please come.
Yeah, that's our podcast. We're sticking to it.
Those were fun days, though. Yeah.
It was fun. We should, you know what? I don't have a lot of time, but I could make time for doing like a virtual book club.
I would, Rhonda. I miss you. I would love that.
Yes, let's do it. Let's have our people call each other.
Yeah.
You know what? I have an agent now. I'll have her call you. Oh
my God.
Okay.
Call me.
See you later, friends. Bye.